All right, here we are with another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Sal, how's it going?
Wonderful.
Good, good, good. Hey, guess what? Aaron Bledsoe's back.
We know his guy.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to let him dictate how the conversation goes, because tonight, we'll timestamp this, tonight's the presidential debate for 2024, and tomorrow's the USDA report. So you want to make predictions on all of those, or would you rather stick to the script?
I'll stick with the script.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Well, you know how this goes. Question of the day, Aaron. What's your favorite vacation spot and activity while you're there?
So we actually just got back from this place a couple weeks ago. My wife and I have been there. We went back for the second time now. Probably Kiawah Island, which is just south of Charleston, South Carolina. And, you know, favorite activity to do there, my wife's, is to go sit on the beach and get as roasted as she possibly can for hours on end. I mean, she loves not really being in the water, just feeling the wind come off the water and listening to the waves. Mine, you know, I like it down there just because even though it's hot, the wind coming off the ocean does make it feel cooler. So it is really relaxing. We both agreed that if I ever hit the lotto, that might be somewhere where we retire. Wow. Because that's the only way I could ever afford to live there. But yeah, Kiawah Island.
And you don't shoot critters there? You don't shoot critters there?
No. I mean, I did see some gators. If they ever opened that up, I mean, I might be able to do that. But yeah, no. I did see deer down there. They look like the size of like a poodle or something. They're pretty small, but
little deer on the East Coast.
Little deer. Yeah, we did go on a dolphin tour in the river system there, which was kind of neat. They have some dolphins that don't leave that area. They just stay right there. And I had to ask him about duck hunting, you know, being on the
coast. I thought you were going to talk about the dolphins. We're going to blink that out.
No, not dolphins. They're off bass.
I got some tuna nets. Those work good.
Oh, my God. Oh my goodness.
And see, what? You thought I was going to be the problem today.
What a horrible person.
Sal's over here trying to trap
dolphins.
Yeah, you're
a horrible, horrible person, Sal. Oh, my goodness. So, where do you go?
Well, I was waiting to hear about the dolphins.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're just neat. They were a little smaller than what you would think of as far as what a dolphin would look like, but they just stay in that river system. The captain we had down there kind of told us a little bit about it. It was pretty neat. I didn't realize that there are pods that just
fresh water or brackish water?
That would have been brackish water or still salt water. He said it took a couple more miles up river before you ever got into some true fresh water. So it was pretty neat.
What?
So you have stories about dolphins?
Not that I'll tell here.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Unreal. All right. Where's your favorite vacation spot? And what do you do while you're there?
Well, my wife and little girl are just like your wife. They would rather go sit on a beach and burn up. Mm-hmm. And I hate that. I take a book or I take something to read and sit in the shade and I just bored out of my mind. So, but where's my favorite spot? So if we do that, my wife and I, we had the best time at, over on the Carolinas. What's it called? Myrtle Beach. Mm-hmm. Yep. We had a really good time there and we stayed at a Hilton and it was 4th of July and we had a big, overlooking the beach. And I mean, every redneck in the Carolinas must've brought fireworks out to the beach and it was dark and you could see them like you would see like a little group of this people was going to set off of rockets or something and they would light it and run this way. And then there was another group over here lighting rockets and they would light it and run this way and they'd like run right into each other's rocket launch areas. And it went on for the first hour. It was really neat. But after that, I'm like, go to bed. Oh, my gosh.
Wow. He said, get off my yard. Get off my beach.
It was like holy in the cow. Morning.
Just it took
kept,
it with you.
Oh, it kept going and going.
The crotchety old man went to the beach.
Yeah. But that sounds kind of like natural selection. If you've got two people lighting stuff off and they run at each other into the other person's spread, that sounds like natural selection.
Oh, right? It was. Well, you're going to force me into a quick story here. So we were setting off fireworks. So we're going into the 4th of July week next week. So this is an appropriate story. And then I'll let you finish. But this, while we're talking about it. So we set off fireworks, a bunch of them at our house one night. Well, I was letting off these big blocks of things. We bought a bunch. And so I errantly thought the one I lit was those things that shoot showers of sparks up there. Yeah. So I set it, I light it, move back away. I don't know how many people are out there. Grandparents, babies. We had babies at that point in time. And as soon as that fuse hit side of that box, the first one that went off was not a shower of sparks. It was an actual projectile that knocked the box on its side point in time.
Oh.
And it would turn about a quarter of a turn, 15 shot box. Now, and when it fell on its side, then it begins to start shooting and it would move the box every time. So every shot was in a different direction. I mean, it shot them into my shop, right down the side of my pickup truck. It cleared the entire family off the approach of our garage. I mean, it was it's funny now, but then it was sort of touch and go for all 15 shots of that. So read the label first before you light them. I thought, well, we'll just set that right here on the gravel. It'll just throw some sparks up in the air. Kids will love this. Nah, it turned out into be an all out sprint.
How many shots did it have?
15.
Oh my God.
So it was a lot.
And the first one put it on its side.
Yeah. Yeah, and what it turned out to be was little army guys with parachutes, but none of them got to use their parachutes because they never got about 6 inches off the ground once it fell on its side.
So, it was a ground attack.
Yep, it was. Yeah. They were suited up to drop in, but we sort of shot them from a parallel to the ground. But so anyway, go ahead.
I know a guy, and he doesn't put them out for display, but he's got like quarter sticks of dynamite, and I mean those things. I would not light one in my hand. I put them on a stick to throw them because it would take your finger. Sure. It would take your hand off.
Sure.
And it's amazing what that'll do. And we were down at it was down there at one of the Jackson Jennings plants back then, but we took and threw one down behind the dry bulk building, and it was like, kaboom. And we're like, let's get out of here. It was after work.
Did it loosen the potash up?
You know, I don't know. We didn't look. We got out of there.
A lot of times potash will wall up. That ought to take care of that.
It would do it. Yeah. It's something else. I mean, it'll lift a garbage can off the ground. And
that's funny.
If you did that, I wouldn't know. But right. Yeah. Right. I would imagine.
Sure. Do you want to throw any illegal fireworks stories in while you're at it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say fireworks. And I didn't do it.
It's a Tannerite story?
Yeah. I just...
Why did we know?
How did we know that?
How did we know?
I felt the percussion a quarter mile away inside the house. Like, the window shook. This is how... I mean, but somebody...
Yeah. I know exactly who it is, probably. But
somebody took a couple pounds of the Tannerite and possibly some H2, which is another form of Tannerite, and they put it under a Volkswagen Beetle.
No.
An old one. Yeah, they put enough stuff underneath it that it sent that Volkswagen Beetle about 10 feet up in the air.
No way.
Yeah, we thought it was the coal mine blasting when I was sitting in my living room. It was not. It was the neighbor. And yeah,
I love America.
Well, what was crazy was they didn't think it'd be too bad, so they shot this stuff from 100 yards away.
Oh, it's too
close. A quarter mile away feeling the windows shake in my house, let alone if I was only 100 yards away from this. I'm sure grandkids has PTSD. They've never seen war, but from that moment, they were done.
And you know, the funny thing is, I would have bet if it was a Tannerite story, I would have put money down and lost it, apparently, that Aaron wasn't the one that shot it. Would be my assumption.
Nope. I was not a part of that one.
Wow. Proud of you.
You were around somewhere in the chain of custody of that Tannerite, probably.
Well, I may or may not have known who was there, but right. I was not personally there.
Plausible deniability is what he's got on this one.
Anybody whose favorite cartoon is Angry Beavers?
Here we go. Yep. We're not doing that again. Okay. All right. Well, I'm finishing up here.
I do have an alter ego down on Kiwa Island. I mean,
I've got pictures.
Yeah.
We can post it.
It is something. It's kind of like if you took Miami Vice and some redneck that you haven't seen in 5 years lived out in the boondocks and mixed them together. It's kind of what you get.
Let me clarify that. There's no Miami Vice.
I was going to say.
There was.
No, there was not. Yeah, you were close to a beach.
Well, no. I mean, I had another outfit that kind of went well with it. I mean, you know, you had some very vibrant colors, swim trunks, and a tank top that had Let's Get Physical with that old 80s workout video. You know how the ladies used to have those tall socks on that bunched up down the bottom? Yeah, it was something.
I know. You know, we're spending a substantial amount of money at his facility based on the fact that he gets customers to sell him grain, and now his credibility completely gone. I mean, at this point,
it has been a while to be on here since then.
Yeah, well, it's not, totally redeem yourself. So, yeah. So, we don't do vacation spots. We don't go the same place twice. So, we just keep moving. So, I would think that probably one that sticks out in my mind, which I would say a regular stop. Carla and I have done it more often than when we've taken the kids. But we like New Braunfels, Texas, Green Hall. We like the music scene in Texas and all that stuff. But if a favorite one that we've done was the Treehouse in the mountains of Georgia a few years back.
You sent pictures of that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So it was like a Vrbo or an Airbnb, but it was a treehouse, and it was off the side of Lookout Mountain, and it was really cool.
So you guys camp too. We do camp.
So, but we've used that a whole one time this year. So we're gonna have to get on it. So, so she's always done the vacations, and I think we talked about it before. She's always done the vacations, and we usually don't know till we get in the car. The other three of us. So, when we pull out of the driveway is when we find out where our destination is, and she's done a fantastic job over the years setting our trips up. So, all right, Aaron, report tomorrow.
Yep.
A little bit of rain. Mm-hmm. Been hot, been dry. Mm-hmm. We've planted from March to June. Mm-hmm. Put that all together for us. Tell us why the market continues to do what it does.
Go. All of what you just said is accurate times 10.
Yeah.
Because it seems like you've got some places that didn't just get some rain. You know, we did. Southern Indiana, we just got, you know, probably roughly about a total of an inch in some spots between the last couple of days over the course of two different rain systems, which has been phenomenal. But we've still got corn that's, you know, calf high. But then we've also got corn that's full-blown tasseling right now, and they're loving this weather. So pollination looks great. But then you've got corn that I don't know when it'll pollinate, really. I mean, I'm not an agronomist, but it seems like it's going to be a while for some of it. And then you've got other areas that can't get away from rain, you know, northern Iowa, southern Minnesota, eastern Nebraska, which, by the way, those three areas are huge, huge production areas. Eastern Nebraska, I think we always hear about the three I's, Illinois, Iowa, and Indiana, and they will disrupt the market. If those three have a hard time or a good time, that will offset a lot of stuff. But eastern Nebraska, man, they've got some good ground out there. And
there's nothing there but corn.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of corn out there.
There's no towns.
To all our Nebraska friends, we meant that in the nicest way.
Holy cow. I mean, there's only like four of them.
Wow.
Sorry.
Wow.
I don't know what to say to that.
Right. Sorry. Try to get us back. Try to keep us on track.
You know, I actually know a couple families out there, and I apologize to them. No, I mean, I think they would even agree that there's probably more cows than people in that state, but I don't know for sure, but.
And they'd be proud of that.
They would be. Yeah,
for sure.
But those areas have gotten a lot of rain, and you know, you've got dams breaking, you've got acres underwater that are probably just a total loss at this point. I mean, they've got a really bad situation. While us down here, the eastern part of the Corn Belt, a little dry, but now all of a sudden we're getting a little bit of favorable weather. So we're back into this whole thing of, you know, last year at this point, we were talking about how Iowa was dry. And, you know, the western part of the Corn Belt, you know, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, they were dry. Well, now it's kind of flip-flop. There's still dry areas, but there's overly saturated areas. So, again, this market is just trying to digest all of this wonkiness. For lack of a term, this year has been wonky. We've got corn that's tasseled, corn that's calf high. We've got beans that are, you know, every bit of thigh high now in some areas, and then we've got some that have just sprouted. We've got wheat that probably came off 2 to 3 weeks earlier than normal, and then we've got weather that's all across the board. So it's trying to digest a lot. And the reason there's two different ways we could take this podcast. We could either go from the speculative side or the trader side, which is fun because, you know, you get to do whatever you want, because it's emotions and you get to digest numbers and stuff. Or you can go from the farmer side, which is a little bit harder to talk about right now because of where the prices are. I mean, it is a very difficult area to have conversations right now about where prices are for fall. And it's almost like you got two complete different parties talking about the same market right now. You've got the trades and then you've got the farmers.
So why don't you cue us up with some of the marketing side of it? And then I'd like to get into a little bit of all the bushels that are still out there, because we're at a funky time right at the moment with what we perceive is to be a lot of bushels still on the farm. So however you want to tie those two together.
So I think we'll go with like the grain stocks first, because that really kind of paints the picture as to why we're at right now, or where we're at right now and why. So I know we're going back in time a little bit, back to March, but that's when the last grain stocks came out. So they come out every quarter. We're going to see that tomorrow. So as far as a timestamp, this is June 27th that we're recording this. June 28th is the acreage and quarterly stocks report. Back in March, when we got a look at the grain stocks, you know, we were talking on farm, or, you know, total, let's just say total, okay? Corn, 8.35 billion bushels stored, okay? So that's up 13% versus last year at this time, at that time. Here's where this gets a little crazy. Off-farm storage, so like your commercial elevators, you know, exporters, things like that, anybody that's storing grain that is not farm-owned, off-farm storage was actually down 1% versus last year. So what does that mean as far as on-farm? On-farm stored corn was up 24% versus the prior year. So what that's saying is that the market knows that there's a lot of corn left out on the farm, and it's going to have to come out at some point. You know, we can always talk about timing and when that comes out, and that's all up for debate or conversation, but at some point it's going to have to come out. You can't hold corn forever. It's got to come out. So you've got the off-farm stores, or your, you know, you've got your feed end users, your ethanol plants, things like that. They know the corn's out there. When is it going to come? Okay. So on beans, you've got kind of got the same story. This time versus last year, and you know, in March, we're 1.85 billion bushels higher, which equates to 9% higher than last year. Off farm, again, this is 3% lower than what they had at this time last year. So your crushers and things like that, they're actually chewing up, or your elevators are getting rid of the stuff. I mean, they're willing to let go of it. The farm, on the other hand, is up 24% as well. So you've got corn and beans, both up, on-farm stocks up 24% versus this time last year. That means there's still a lot of bushels out there. So what does that do? Well, when the market feels like there's a lot of corn or beans still left out there, you know, it thinks that we're going to have a lot of bushels being carried into the new crop. So that puts less of a risk on new crop. New crop can suffer a little bit more, and the market really doesn't care much because they're like, what? We've still got a bunch out there. At some point, it's going to come. It's just a matter of when. So that's kind of how we've got to this point right now, is that, you know, whether you're in southern Indiana or Iowa or wherever, you know, the nation is different. Again, last year we had dry areas, we had good areas. We've been fortunate in southern Indiana. We've had some really good years when other people have kind of struggled. And so that's where this on-farm stock position really kind of puts pressure on this market. Because as soon as those bushels start coming out, your commercial elevators and the hedging part of this, whether you're an end user elevator, it doesn't matter. When those bushels leave the farm and hits the market, people hedge their risk. So they sell futures. And when you sell something, you're putting pressure on the board. So is the bleeding done yet? I have no idea. I'm not, you know, we can talk about predictions of where this stuff's going, but right now that's how we've gotten to where we are. The market feels like they know there's a lot of bushels out there, and they're not flinching. They just know that it's going to come at some point because somebody's got to pay bills. It's going to come. So
you said you can't store forever. Mm-hmm. And there's a – tell our listeners some of the reasons why. I mean, obviously, you got to have money.
Yeah. Cash flow is a big one. You know, I think that's – I wouldn't say that's the first one in mind, okay. Sadly. I would almost say, you know, I guess it depends who you talk to. The good ones out there will say, you know, I know that I can't hold it forever because I got to do cash flow. And if I do it at this time, then it aligns with the market for a profitability, things like that. But quality also just goes downhill. And when you get poor quality, then all of a sudden you start taking more docks, or it just becomes rejectable and nobody wants it. So, it, you know, as long as you maintain it, it'll store in bins for quite a while. So I'm not here saying that you got to move it in like 6 months. It'll keep, but you have to stay up on it. You have to monitor it. You have to know what you're doing, or at least talk to somebody that can help you figure it out as far as how to store it. That's why I say that it can't hold it forever. And eventually I've talked about the job of the basis before. The job of the basis is to move bushels from where they are to where they're not. At some point, and we're seeing this here lately, which is typical for this time of year, you'll see basis strengthen a little bit because guys are busy in the field or they've got other things going on and they're taking vacations, just like we were talking about. It's that time of year where grain flow usually slows up a little bit in the last, this month and last month because of field work and everything like that, and you'll see basis improve. Well, right now I think you're seeing it improve because farmers are just saying, I'm not willing to sell at this price. So then basis steps in. If the market's not going to do its job or do the heavy lifting, I don't want to say not do its job, but if it's not going to do the heavy lifting like we've seen in the last couple of years, basis will then start to try to pull it out for the end user who have to have it to produce the product that they're going after.
So holding on to the grain is going to exacerbate make a moderate crop look big. Mm-hmm. So they're not looking at any harvest basis improvement with the market knowing that there's that many bushels sitting out there. So waiting just pushes the problem back.
It does. It just pushes the problem back. You're at that point, if you say, I'm going to hold it and see what happens, you're hoping for a weather issue. You're hoping for a supply issue at that point. You're putting your eggs in that basket. And that's a tricky one because those are flash and frying pan type markets. A demand market is a longer drawn out market. So if we have a really good demand story, those prices seem to hang around for a while, which we've seen in the last couple of years. Those prices were more resilient to hang up and stay up in some elevated levels. So you have a supply thing. We saw it last year, I think at the end of July, where we saw $1.50 run up in corn, and then we lost all of it in a matter of 3 days. It took a week to do it, and then we lost it in a couple. So that's where the supply is. If there's any weather risk, anything like that, those are very quick market movers. Demand takes longer.
So when that made that run up, that kind of taught us a bad habit, right? I mean, that's a bad lesson to learn because it kind of rewarded taking on more risk, because if you're holding on to corn this late, I mean, a lot of things can go wrong. You just kind of named off a bunch, right? The quality goes down. Your working capital interest rates are clicking along high. Mm-hmm. With 24% still out there, I mean, do we have that type of overcapacity of storage that?
No, we don't. And that alludes to what Ryan was getting at, in that it just pushes the problem further out, in that at some point, that's another reason why it has to move. You've got new crop that you're going to go get, regardless of what the size of the crop is. You know, if we have a really bad failure, some people will be able to hold their old crop and new crop with the harvest. But we're talking about a sizable crop failure at that point.
Yeah.
So when you hold it longer, you're put into a position of, okay, then I have to move it because I just don't have enough storage for it. So that's when you don't see basis values improve for new crop at all. You see it go down even more because everyone's staring down at this thing and they're going, how are we going to handle it? You know, if the farms are packed, that means there's more pressure on the commercial elevators. And when they fill up, you know, then it's going to, you know, end users get what they need. And so it's just kind of a domino effect. You know, this isn't all doom and gloom, but that's where this farm side comes in that you kind of see how we've gotten here, where the farm said, I'm not willing to sell at this price. And for good reasons. You know, we have been dry. It's not that guys have made poor decisions. It's just that the reality is they've been faced with this market and they've been trying to figure it out. And they've been hedging their bets on, you know, it looked a little dry. We don't know if the acres are going to be there for corn. I think we're willing to roll the dice.
So we could spec a supply market just a little bit by, here's what we know is happening in the weather and other geographies. Here's what we know is happening at home. I look outside and, you know, the 80 acres behind my house is rolled up tight. It's a problem, and there's a little bit of rain to forecast. But we don't spec on a demand. We get demand as that's information that we get fed as farmers and as producers. What's the demand market saying?
So, you know, as far as the demand side goes, there's with lower prices, it does lend itself to you being more appetizing for exports because people can start buying your stuff cheaper than other people, you know. So it's a double-edged sword. You know, typically we don't see super, super high demand with super, super high prices unless there's issues everywhere else, which is what we've had before. You know, we've had, I don't want to say real huge issues, but we've had a South America crop the last couple of years where, you know, in previous years, where production just wasn't normally what they thought it was going to be or wasn't going to grow as much as they thought as far as the acreage or total production in bushels. So then the U.S. was having a good year. We were the game in town, and you had the Black Sea confrontation and all that. We've had so many things that have kind of bottlenecked this thing up to say we've been able to take advantage of good production and good prices while everybody else has had issues. Now it's starting to come back where we're trying to decipher what this new crop looks like while everybody else has had reasonably good production. And so we're starting to see prices come down, which leads into the demand. If prices are lower, usually that means demand kind of picks up because somebody sees a bargain out there. You know, this is still a buy and sell type thing. When you start talking nationally and globally, you're trying to buy the cheapest product that you can if you're someone else. And so at these low prices, it does make one think that maybe demand will be substantial or at least hang on. The fear is that demand falters and supply is good. That's like worst case scenario. But right now they are still projecting a pretty good total usage. I mean, usage is up from last year is what they're projecting for this new 24-25 crop. So that's not bad. The biggest question is that there's just so much left out there from this last one.
You mentioned the South America. What's the what's current events down there, the weather wise?
You know, the big question or the big thing that kind of led for a little bit of a rally early spring was that certain parts of Brazil had a lot of flooding. You know, we're talking record flooding, dams breaking, people losing houses, which was that's real. That's real. What they're projecting onto the market was that bean harvest, there were still a lot of beans out there that were underwater now. So that means total Brazil production is going to be lower because they can't get it or the quality is going to suck on that stuff. So they're not going to be able to sell it. Reality was, is that where that flooding was, production was pretty much done. I mean, we're talking, was it a real event? Absolutely. Real event, had real problems with it, took some acres, but to move the needle, it didn't affect enough of the bushels to move the needle too much. So that was another one of those where this is a supply problem and we saw it react. And then it, you know, once we got to know some of this information, it started to falter.
So in a situation like that, how much time do they have to make a decision? How long did that last till they verified that story?
That one hung around for a little while. I'm going to say a couple weeks, but they're all different.
Sure.
I mean, and that's where this, you know, supply issues, they're all different until it's known because it's all conjecture. It's all, well, I feel like this is a bad crop or I feel like this is a real problem. Are you catching what I'm saying? Feel. There's emotions in this. You know, and there's emotions at the farm level, but at the farm level, we're in a risk management type role. The trade side is more of, okay, well, how do I make risk? You know, how do I play this market? You know, I feel the market's looking at this thing going, farms, there's a lot of bushels out there. So I'm going to sell this thing because, you know, at some point I'm going to short this market because they're going to move it. And as soon as that price keeps going dropping down, they're gonna bank their profits and get out of it. So the market doesn't feel like there's much of a reason for prices to go up. The farm level feels like there's a reason for prices to go up. So we've got these two things. In the past, both of these have been working together, and no one was complaining about where prices were, or I don't want to say not complaining about where prices were, but they were thankful for the trade, you know, the traders in the group. These are still people doing these trades, taking educated guesses. They're looking at the same numbers farms are looking at. They're just using those numbers in a different way. They're looking at it to bank, to make money off of the market, whereas farms are trying to still use the market to make money, but they use it slightly differently, you know? So we just got two different stories here. Before, we kind of had the same one where they're lining up where, yeah, prices should go up. Farm felt like that. The market said, yep, we agree. And they drove it up. Now we're starting to see it on the other side where the trade's saying, ah, there's the potential's there. I mean, if we talk about the crop progress, good to excellent, we're significantly higher than we were last year on beans and corn. Does it feel like it here? No.
No, it doesn't feel like it.
It doesn't feel like it. And so you got the farm saying, nope, that's wrong. Trade saying, I don't care. This is what the USDA is saying. So until you tell me otherwise, that's what I'm going to trade.
So the report tomorrow, regardless of if it's bullish or bearish, does it trigger sales either way?
I think so. I think so. I mean, we're in that transition period. So, you know, the crop cycle, for those of you that are not in ag, it goes, you know, from September 1 to the end of August, typically. So you've got your new crop coming in the fall. That turns into old crop after December into January. That turns into old crop. And so prices react differently through this whole cycle. You know, you've got new crop where you're talking harvest basis, things like that. Then you go into January through May, I would say, where this is, okay, the end users need to pull it out of the farm. They need bushels to meet their demand or their need. And then you go into this transition window in this June, July, August phase. It can lead to some really good prices or it can lead to some really tough times because if the end users don't have what they need, they're going to try pulling it out and you're going to see them work hard to get it, which is favorable for the farm level. But at the same time in this transition period, if they have what they need and they don't really, you know, if they're not worried about getting into new crop, it's not a good time. You won't see much fluctuation. So all bets are off in July, August, because you're talking new crop weather and you're talking what's left out on the farm. What do the end users have on hand? Do they have enough to make it to new crop? If they do, you don't see basis work real hard. So we're in this transition period. Futures and farm basis it'll vary. I mean, all bets are off. And it'll be very isolated. You can have a spot where, man, they're really paying for corn and they really want it, or those crushers really need the beans. And then you'll have other places that, okay, drive across state lines, go deliver it there because I don't need it right now. So this is a real funky time that we're getting into as far as the transition period.
Wow.
So what are you telling people when they call?
So
they're probably not calling much right now, are they?
No, phones are really quiet right now. You know, I mean, we've still been blessed with good production. So let's not lose that fact. Farms have had good production. They've got a lot of bushels to still move. There's still money sitting out there. It's not like we're out of bushels and prices suck and we can't do anything with it. Right now, it's still, you know, we still have something to sell and we still have opportunity out there to do some things to help. But yeah, phones are really quiet. What I would tell people and what I've been telling people for the last couple of months is you do not want to be on the back half of this movement when the bushels move. Okay. From a technical standpoint, when you get on the back half, that means people have already put pressure on this market because they're moving bushels. Okay. If you get on the back half of that, that means you're possibly looking at where the damage has already been done and it's already been pushed lower. Now, if we do have a supply thing to turn this positive, I don't want to say positive because nobody wants to have a bad production. That just doesn't feel good. But if there are some areas where this crop isn't what they say it is, then there is reason for prices to hold or improve some. Mm-hmm. You know, from the speculative side and, you know, and even at the farm level when I talk to people, I don't think we're going to hit this 181 yield goal. It feels like we've got too much variability. And variability leads to opportunities in the market. But right now for variability for a yield like 181, which was going to be a record, that's just going to be tough. So I've looked back and I'm like, okay, well, what happens? You know, so here comes the speculation or trying to come up with some plan for, I don't want to say plan, but if people already have a certain percentage of their new crop sold and they're looking at taking some more risk off the table or playing the what if scenarios, okay, well, what if we drop it down to 177? Okay. I went back and looked at the last couple of years. You know, in 22, 23, they were estimating 177. We came at 173. Last year, they estimated 181.5. We came at 177.3. So if we can just come out to where we've been the last couple of years, or if we just come kind of maintain that trend of being 4 bushels under what they expect for the big caveat here is 15 to 18, we're way above those numbers. You know, we were above what they projected us to do. We were 4 bushels over. So this could go either way. But if we want to play the side of the yield's not there, regardless of what the acres does, if the yield's not there, if we can drop it down to 177, then all of a sudden that projected ending stocks to use rate of 14.2% becomes 11.8%. That's much more appetizing for prices to hold or increase than 14.2. 14.2, you're starting to get back into that, like I said, you know, 16 into 20 or 16 into 18, 19 range. That's a high stocks to use rate, which means stocks to use rate means that we just have a lot left over above our demand. So, and beans, you know, the biggest thing, a lot of the trades saying that there's going to be a slight uptick in corn acres. We'll see tomorrow. We'll find out. But they're projecting a lot of bean acres to come on the table. they felt like it did feel like the total acreage number was a little low. But, you know, some acres could have been rolled into CRP, hay ground, you know, wheat could have taken some. It felt like total acreage use was low. So I think the market's thinking that there's going to be a lot of beans because beans are cheaper to put out than corn. And the planting window that we had this year, it did make it feel like there's probably the potential for more beans is there because of the delayed in corn. So
I don't know how widespread it was, but you did see a few bean fields that went back into beans second year in a row. And you just thought, that's a decision mm-hmm. at some point in time. Somebody, I mean, they weren't forced to that due to the planting date. They weren't forced to that. That was a plan.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's just a lot of things that you can throw at this crop right now that, you know, you talk about people that put on anhydrous in the fall because they do fall anhydrous applications instead of spring anhydrous applications. Then you're talking about leaching, you know, is the yield going to be there because the anhydrous leached, or, you know, pre-plant acres because you did a fall application for corn, but you couldn't get in there. So now you can't even put wheat beans in there. So there's just so much going on, and that's where emotions will wreak havoc on this. You know, I've talked about emotions before back when prices were $6-$7 and what that roller coaster looks like. This is a whole different set of emotions. You know, back then when you go from $6.75 to $6.50, you're like, they really stuck it to me. Like,
dang it.
But I mean, guys, we're still selling $6.50 corn.
Yeah.
Now when we're talking, okay, well, a couple months ago, we could have sold $4.50, $4.75 corn for fall. Now we're talking, you know, $4.25. It's a different feel, a totally different feel. So emotions right now are probably going to be high. And I can understand why they have every legitimate reason to be high right now, as far as this doesn't feel good. But you asked earlier about how long those little trends lasted. That's why we do targets. Because even if it lasted only 24 hours, if you have a working order sitting there and it runs up and taps it, you know, sometimes these overnights will do a rebound and they'll look like they're going to try to make a run for the day. And then by noon, they fall off the earth and they actually do a complete reversal. If we have a target, then you potentially have that opportunity to get it locked in before it does that reversal. So they're just a tool that we have. And, you know, any elevator can do them, but that's why we believe in them, is because it kind of takes some of the emotion out. You put a flag in the ground saying, at this, I'm willing to do it. And you kind of said, emotions take the back seat. This is my first step. This is what I'm going to do. Right now, you'll see a lot more people trying to do, I don't know how else to say it other than cute things of, well, if I do this and then I do that, then the aggregate of this means I get this. And now is the time for discipline. You know, you don't want to just sit here and just willy-nilly try to try all these different things and hope that it works. Get back to basics and just come up with a solid plan and work from there. If we get an opportunity, guess what? You didn't sell 100%. You have an opportunity to take advantage of some other things out there. But right now, just I think we need to get some of the risk taken care of. If somebody's undersold, I'm telling them, let's just take a portion because it may get better, but it may get worse. So what does that do to your operation? If it gets better, obviously, you have more cash. If it gets worse, what's that detriment to you? You know, can you withstand it if it takes another 50-cent loss for new crop? Or do we need to just take some of the risk off right now? So,
all right.
You want to look like a genius or an idiot? You want to tell us what the report's going to say tomorrow?
There's one last caveat to this is that you got South America, CONAB.
And this won't come out till after it's out, so yeah. We'll know automatically.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got CONAB and you got USDA. They're quite a ways apart on what they expect South America total production to be. At some point, they're going to have to come together. Is it going to come closer to the USDA number or is it going to come closer to the CONAB? CONAB's saying a lot less. USDA's saying a lot more. Those have to come together at some point. If it comes to closer to the CONAB, that's what the bulls in this market are waiting for. They're like, USDA, you don't know. It's, CONAB's closer to the reality. If CONAB starts to come up to USDA, then we haven't seen the price deterioration done yet. Because that's another piece of this old crop going into this new crop for us that is still trying to get figured out. If I had to put a number on it today, there's people smarter than me. I do feel like maybe that corn acre number is probably a little low. I never underestimate a farmer on how many acres he can get planted. We saw that in 19.
They do it hard. Yeah, they
extremely
do it well.
Extremely delayed planting, and they still came out with more acres than what we have right now. You know, in 19, I'd have to go back and look at those numbers, but I know we got a lot more acres planted than what they're projecting for right now. Guys like corn, and with emotions high, I have to wonder if people didn't chase the market a little bit of playing.
It'll come.
Joe down the road's not going to plant corn. I'm going to plant corn.
It'll come.
Yeah. So I'm going to say that I don't think we see a lot of corn acres go up, but I'm still going to stick with the, 90 and a half, maybe up to 91 million acres of corn. I do feel like that bean acre is probably going to go up though. They were suggesting, 86 and a half. I'd say that ends up being 87 and a half. Nobody likes to see a field empty.
Right.
And I may be wrong. I probably am wrong, which is why I don't do that part for a living. But from a farm level, I do think we need to get some targets. We've got an average contract that's been working, and I can tell you right now, starting it when we did, that helps out this a lot because we had those first 5 weeks that were significantly higher than where we are right now. We're on the back end of this thing. We just did week 8. We've got 2 more weeks. The first 6 weeks were good. Now, that's why we do these, is that you kind of play that law of average out here. It's still going to be higher than what it is right now or potentially for fall. So,
okay. Anything else?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. The big thing is you got to remember this is a global and national thing. This is not, your basis is local. Futures market are not local for the most part. So just because we feel a little hot or a little dry or we have problems doesn't mean that we technically have one on a mass scale to affect these markets. We're no longer the big leader in the world. I mean, we still are from a perspective of we can still throw some weight around, but South America is producing a lot of stuff. China's got heat right now. That could play into it. They haven't came into the market. That's what's got this market depressed right now. They haven't came in and bought a bunch of beans like normal for new crop. There's just not much going on. So lack of news typically leads to lower prices. So I know it's really emotional right now. Don't get down. There's still opportunity out there. There's still plans. We can still work around stuff. But now it's making sure that pencil's really sharp, figuring stuff out.
Okay. Right. Sounds good. Well, we'll find out when this releases. We'll know how good of a job you did with your predictions. So Thankfully, it'll come out at a point where nobody can make a decision off your prediction.
Yeah,
they'll have the report.
Yeah, so they may not even listen to this one. They may just say, like, what do I need to listen to that? The report's out.
Yeah, for sure. So, all right. Well, I appreciate it, and we hope to have you back. Maybe we'll have news all summer, I'm sure, mm-hmm. as we go through. So, and you've got some projects you'll want to report on sooner or later at each facility. So, mm-hmm. We'll plan on having you back here in a few weeks. So, that's another episode of the High Ground powered by Premier Companies. Please like and subscribe.